This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
If you want to buy a Ford Mustang, you're all set. Any other Ford sedan, not so fast. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal, the 26th day of April today, Thursday. Glad as always to have you along, everybody. The corporate story of the day today contains within it an industrial story, a commodities story, a global trade story, and a, wow, that's an interesting move story. Ford Motor Company announced late yesterday it's going to stop making cars for the North American market, save the iconic Mustang. Dan Neal writes on cars for the Wall Street Journal. Dan, it's good to have you on.
Great to be here, Kai.
We should be clear here that we're talking just cars, mostly, not everything that Ford's doing, right? Let's establish the ground rules.
Sure. We're talking about their product strategy in North America and the rest of the world. Yes.
Okay. Now, why, man? Because the headline saying Ford's going to stop building cars do seem a bit, it seems big.
You know, a lot of people have taken this news very hard because of the emotional significance of the Ford Motor Company, the company that started mass mobility with the Model T and, you know, so much of our American automotive bedrock is Ford. But this is not a unexpected outcome. Ford is always clear that their center of competence is bigger. And these days, bigger vehicles are more profitable. And so it seems like almost as if they push the issue. You know, car makers always say they build what people want, but they never mention the fact that they spend billions to tell them what they want. It wasn't just that consumers spontaneously desired a truck that was as big as a house. No, that was a gradual process. And it has been pushed by the automakers primarily because bigger equals more profit.
Okay, but wait, hold your nellies here for a minute, because you and I both know that gas prices are not going to stay as low as they are forever, right? And as soon as gas prices keep going up, are Americans going to keep buying the crossover SUVs and the big cars and the big trucks that Ford is now banking on?
Well, you remember that Star Trek episode where they're like caught in a causality loop and no matter what they did, they kept making the same mistakes, you know, being hurtling toward the same, you know, demise. This is the very same mistake the companies made in the 90s and the 2000s during the gas spike. And really, the language of Wall Street and investment doesn't give them any kind of dialogue with the future. You know, they have to maximize their profits now. They cannot plan for what is obviously the inevitable. They can make money on big trucks, big SUVs and crossovers and not really worry about the rest of the world, but it doesn't set them up to be competitive in the long run.
Well, talk to me then for a minute about the part of the global car market that is not North America, right? Because they have to compete in China, they have to compete in South America, they have to compete in Europe as well.
Do they? I don't know that they're thinking that at all. I think they're very happy behind the, you know, Fortress of America walls. Look, you know, Ford pulled out of Europe for the most part. GM suffered a whole big setback in Korea and restructuring just in the past quarter. And most of all, the biggest weather maker of all is China's new EV mandates. You know, these are much more strict. And these companies are not set up to compete in China.
Help me understand the causality loop here for a second. Is what you're saying basically that it's that old definition of insanity, right? They keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results.
You know, every time these conditions present themselves, car makers look for the most profitable way to exploit their opportunities. And how long before Ford builds another excursion? Remember the Simpsons Canyonero? That's going to happen, you know, and that's the other. It's the death of shame, right? You know, they are building just as big as they can get. Consumers are afraid to be in smaller cars when they're surrounded by increasingly taller vehicles.
And meanwhile, I paid $3.63 a gallon for gas the other day.
Oh, yeah. And that's the other thing. You know, I do believe that people believe that there was always going to be an oil glut and that oil prices would never go up. I believe there a lot of investment was made on that basis. And I, you know, in my experience, that doesn't last forever. But I'm not a very rich man, so I don't know.
Dan Neely writes on cars for the Wall Street Journal. Dan, thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you, Guy. Nice to be here.
The corporate off-lead today, as it were, is the money printing machine that trades under the ticker symbol FB. Facebook took in 63% more profit the first 3 months of this year over a year earlier, despite all the distractions that company is dealing with. Marketplace's Rima Kreis explains what's going on there.
42-year-old Christine Free, the social worker from Canada, has always been on the fence about Facebook. It felt creepy to her. Then after the news broke about Cambridge Analytica harvesting user data, she was done.
I knew that by being a social activist that was creating content on Facebook, I was merely creating more data for Facebook to sell.
She ditched it as part of a social media movement known as hashtag delete Facebook. Still, these past 3 months, Facebook added 70 million monthly active users.
The value proposition is still well intact.
Mark Mahaney is an analyst at RBC Capital Markets. He says, bottom line, Facebook is beloved, especially by advertisers. It's one of the only platforms that gives them mass market reach, plus the tools to hyper-target.
If you're selling suburban minivans, there's a certain demographic that you want to target in a suburb of Milwaukee. So Facebook gives you one of the best platforms to run that campaign. That hasn't changed one iota.
But
this story isn't quite over yet.
Max Wolf of the Phoenix Group says the fallout from the Cambridge Analytica scandal may have not made a dent in recent earnings because those numbers only capture January through March. The scandal broke mid-March.
So we should be a bit cautious.
And Wolf says next month, when strict new European privacy regulations kick in, that could slow growth for Facebook.
This is making Europe a little bit less profitable, a little bit less easy to negotiate for anyone who trades on public data.
For now, Facebook just sails on. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Shares of both F and FB were up today, as were the broader indices. Lots of guesses as to why. Of course, here's mine. The news that Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin is going to lead a delegation to China at the end of next week, meaning the trade war is off for now. More trade later in the program. By the way, on Wall Street, details, numbers, you know the drill. I'm going to run a word by you here that you might have heard popping up of late, and that depending on how things go economy-wise, you might hear more of. Stagflation is the word. Sabri Benishore is the reporter.
So inflation, prices rising all around you, that usually happens when the economy is booming. It's not great, but at least the economy is heating up, unemployment's going down. Now, on the other end of things, you can have a sluggish economy. Low growth, maybe worsening unemployment. It sucks, but at least inflation is low. Julia Coronado runs Macro Policy Perspectives.
The worst scenario is when you have high inflation but sluggish growth.
Because think about it. Inflation's rising, prices are going up, but wages aren't. Unemployment's not improving. Stagflation is an unpleasant place to be.
It's a problem because it erodes our standard of living.
Jim Paulson, chief investment strategist at the Luthold Group, thinks we might just be headed there.
I think in a mild form, we're going to face a little bit of that. We might see real economic growth, you know, slow from close to 3% back to, you know, 2 to 2.5%, while we see consumer price inflation rise from the low twos up towards 3%.
Joseph Gagnon at the Peterson Institute for International Economics doesn't think we're going to get stagflation this year. Tax cuts are going to boost the economy for a little bit, so we should get growth.
But looking out further, I do think it's a risk for 2020 or 2021.
He says this because eventually the economy will burn too hot.
The Fed will have to put on the brakes sharper than we think.
Unemployment could rise, and inflation would keep going for a while.
And then that could be a period of stagflation.
The last period of serious stagflation stretched from 1979 to 1982. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The big education story getting a lot of press right now is the newfound energy a lot of teachers' unions have. Thousands of teachers in Arizona and Colorado walked out today protesting low pay and low funding for their state's public schools. Education's a big story in Puerto Rico right now, too, just not getting a whole lot of press. Schools there are in the middle of a massive reorganization. 280 public schools are going to close, resources are going to be pooled, and charter schools and vouchers are on their way. Yes, it's about Hurricane Maria, in part. Lizzie O'Leary, the host of Marketplace Weekend, has that story.
It's pretty normal to have a bunch of teachers, parents, and kids outside an elementary school at 7:45 in the morning. Generally, though, you don't see a 7-year-old chanting with a protest sign. They're saying, "I want a school that's open." And they're referring to John F. Kennedy Elementary School in Toa Baja, about 15 miles outside San Juan. JFK is one of 280 public schools slated to close over the summer. That's roughly a third of the island's schools. Enrollment has dropped across Puerto Rico since Hurricane Maria. The Education Department says it's down by 38,000 students since May. Uria Vargas sends her daughter Gabriela to JFK. She's 9, and she's a special ed student. If the school closes, Vargas says, the next school closest to them is 30 minutes away. Even though she has a car, she says getting there would be really difficult and it would really affect them. What the island's government wants to do is consolidate schools, some with declining enrollment and some with lower test scores or buildings in bad shape. Teachers' unions are fighting the closures and a plan from the governor that would allow for charter school and voucher pilot programs starting in 2019. JFK Elementary's building has a pretty courtyard and cheerful decorations. Online records show the school's test scores need work and that the number of students here has declined in the past few years as the island suffered its debt crisis. But teachers argue that the numbers are bouncing back, even as they note that the principal left for the mainland after Maria. Pierrette Hidalgo's second-grade classroom is decorated with drawings of Spider-Man. The room's door shows him climbing through a city at night. Inside, 15 students sit in little groups learning about important historical sites in Puerto Rico. But there's a sign in the classroom that underscores how tense things are right now. It reads, "Education is not for sale." The whole situation feels raw, like no one trusts each other. And up front, on the whiteboard, it says, "Julia Kelleher wants to close my school." Kelleher is the Secretary of Education. She worked as a consultant to Puerto Rico schools for about a decade, but only started in this job last year. She says the closure plan could save $150 million. She's both ambitious and the target of a lot of anger. In protests like the one at JFK, people chant, "Julia, go home." I ask Kelleher why she thinks things have gotten so nasty.
I don't know. I mean, it's difficult. People are being confronted with a reality that has been hidden for the last 10 to 15 years. The debt crisis and $73 billion didn't just pop up, right? So someone coming in to do the things and being honest and transparent about the why and making those tough decisions doesn't make it hurt any less.
And then, of course, in the middle of all of this are the kids. Many went through the storm or lost homes. JFK's social worker, Maria Dolores Torres, says they're already traumatized. She says she lost her voice because of the stress.
And the entire government isn't visualizing the specific experience of the children, the need of the children. A loss, another loss. These are a lot of losses at one time. They're mourning, and the kids need to recover. I mean, our kids lost everything. What else can I say?
I'm Lizzie O'Leary for Marketplace.
Coming up.
We're not going to wash down sidewalks one day only to see an encampment return the next and people not helped.
They call them homeless sweeps here in Los Angeles. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 238 today, 1%, 24,322. The NASDAQ up 114 points, 1.6%, 7118. S&P 500 grew 27 points, 1% there as well, 2666. We told you about Ford's decision to put the brakes on most of its car lines and focus on cars and SUVs instead, rather trucks, SUVs instead. Ford pumped up 2.8%. General Motors climbed 0.3%. Fiat Chrysler delivered about 2% today. Facebook cashed in on its strong earnings report. The social network clicked up 9%. Snapchat parent company Snap, I never understood that name change, by the way, it rose 1.1%. Of course, nobody asked me. Twitter grew 1.75%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.98%. You're listening to Marketplace. As a nonprofit news organization, Marketplace is on a mission, one that's really all about you. Everything we do is aimed at making people smarter about the financial forces that govern our lives, encouraging civil discourse, and making better decisions for you and your family. And we've been doing it for almost 30 years, but we are always thinking bigger and better. And that's where we need your help. The more people who support Marketplace, the more we can do to raise economic intelligence across the country. Right now, your donation will go twice as far thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from Candida. Time is running out on the challenge, so please become a Marketplace investor today in whatever amount works for you at Marketplace.org. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We're going to do another update now on the Trump administration's steel and aluminum tariffs and how, even as Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin gets set to go talk trade in Beijing, American companies are hustling to not have to deal with those tariffs. The Commerce Department has gotten more than 2,200 exemption requests from companies big and small all over this country, and not just steel producers either, but as we mentioned yesterday, fish hook manufacturers and makers of whiteboards. More than 500 of these exemption requests have been posted at regulations.gov for public comment, including one posted today from RM Creations in South Plainfield, New Jersey. They make stainless steel parts that go into appliances like dishwashers and washing machines. Sam Desai is a vice president there.
I cannot make any plans. I'm kind of lost right now.
He applied for the exemption about 3 weeks ago, he says, and now he is just stuck.
Well, indirectly, my business employees are based on how much business we have. And with these tariffs, as of today, that business has reduced quite a bit. Nobody's placed future orders with us.
Quick reminder here that the exemptions you've been hearing us talk about for European Union steel with the Emmanuel Macron and Angela Merkel visits expire on May the 1st. Also, it's not just steel and aluminum that Secretary Mnuchin's going to China to talk about. There's that $50 billion or more of tariffs meant to punish China for its intellectual property theft as well. This has been a mixed bag kind of day for Trump administration officials on Capitol Hill. CIA Director Mike Pompeo was confirmed as Secretary of State and promptly headed off on his first overseas trip in his new job. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt, meanwhile, spent a couple of very uncomfortable hours testifying before a couple of House committees facing questions about his agency's budget and about his behavior as well. Elsewhere in the executive branch, Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson wants to change the way the government handles rental assistance for poor people, commonly known as Section 8. Catch is, Congress is going to have to buy in, which may or may not be happening. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more on that.
The Trump administration says the Section 8 program, which covers about 4.7 million people, is eating up more and more of the budget, but not helping enough. Here's Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson in a conference call with reporters.
The way we calculate the level of assistance to our families is convoluted and creates perverse consequences, such as discouraging these families from earning more income and becoming self-sufficient.
HUD wants to make it easier for local housing authorities to impose work requirements. The proposal also calls for renters to contribute 35% of their gross income, a change from the current 30% of adjusted income and with fewer exemptions. Eva Rosen studies housing policy at Georgetown University.
Currently, the poorest families pay $50 a month in rent, and they're going to raise that from $50 to $150 a month.
Diane Levi of the Urban Institute says one of the goals is to ease the administrative burden. But she says the moves may not actually help people get off rental assistance.
The research has shown that there can be some improvements in self-sufficiency, but not to the point that people are actually able to afford housing on the private market without assistance.
The HUD proposal is just that, proposed legislation that Congress would have to approve. But Secretary Carson says it's the start of a necessary conversation. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
In his State of the City speech a month or so ago, Eric Garcetti, the mayor of Los Angeles, said growing street homelessness is this city's biggest problem. The homeless population in L.A. grew more than 20% last year, and overall, three-quarters of the homeless here live outside. There have been homeless camps along what's known as Skid Row in downtown for years now, but new tent cities are popping up on sidewalks across the city, drawing complaints from neighbors and a bump in city-sanctioned homeless encampment sweeps. In his new budget proposal out last week, Garcetti added money for more of those sweeps with one big catch, as Marketplace's Aaron Schrank explains.
For the past year, Albert Gaytan's been camping with 15 others along a quiet back street just down the hillside from Million Dollar Homes. He gets why neighbors complain. He points to a knee-deep trash pile at the center of camp people are sorting through.
It has to be cleaned up. It's intolerable. This is ridiculous, and that's ridiculous. That this is worse than the dump, okay?
In one day, it'll be gone, and so will everyone here. Public works crews will sweep the encampment. In most cases, the homeless will just return the next day. But Gaytan says after a year of trash, drug use, and late-night noise, police have threatened campers with arrest if they return.
And today's our very last day. At 8 o'clock in the morning, they will be here to clear this out. They're going to turn into a dog park.
Last year, L.A. spent $7 million sending police officers and sanitation workers to clean and clear thousands of encampments. Now it wants to double the effort to meet a backlog of requests from angry residents. But will spending more to sweep away the homeless address any of the root causes keeping them on the streets? People like Christina Escalante?
The residents tell us they don't like us. We're lowlife. We're drug addicts. I'm not a drug addict. I don't use. Everybody has a different situation.
She's a 50-year-old registered nurse who's been camping here since she became homeless 9 months ago. Escalante has an eviction on her record, which she says makes it harder to rent anywhere.
Every day is a get up, and it's a struggle to get water, and you've got no electricity, so you can't charge your phone. It's really hard.
And so what happens tomorrow then? Where do you go?
I don't know. We're trying to find a place tonight.
Most homeless camps get swept by the city every few months with one day's notice. But in some homeless hotspots, these cleanups are more routine. On this morning and every Friday morning, a 16-vehicle procession of police cars and city works trucks rolls down the boardwalk in Venice Beach. It wakes up the homeless and clears trash and other belongings before crowds of tourists arrive.
Doing the Lord's work.
The procession rolls to a stop in front of Dondrell Lee, a homeless artist. He negotiates with police over his neatly stacked canvases and art supplies, all wrapped in a tarp and sitting on the boardwalk.
You guys have had all day. You've seen this coming down here. That doesn't fit in the 60-gallon right there, man.
Oh, no, this.
These city workers are enforcing a law that says homeless people can't have more than 60 gallons of stuff with them in public. They won't make any exceptions for Lee. He has to fit what he can into a plastic bag and hand the rest of his belongings over to the sanitation workers.
Get the most important stuff, and the rest of the stuff we will put in storage.
All right.
Lee's been sleeping on this boardwalk for 2 years and says he welcomes the trash cleanup, but he doesn't see any sanitary or safety benefit to confiscating his art.
It's not trash. People bend rules all the time. You see how the guy was lenient with me, and then me and him did it together. The cleanup crew, they didn't even touch anything.
Now, L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti says only neighborhoods that build new temporary emergency shelters will get extra funding to clean encampments. The city needs at least 25,000 shelter beds. Right now, 8,000 are available. Without more, Garcetti says sweeps won't help.
We can't sweep or move homelessness away. We're not going to wash down sidewalks one day only to see an encampment return the next and people not helped. It doesn't get a single person off the street with that strategy.
L.A. voters passed a billion-dollar bond a couple of years ago to fund 10,000 more permanent housing units for the homeless. The mayor's deputy chief of staff, Matt Szabo, says the challenge is convincing people to welcome housing for the homeless in their own neighborhoods.
Homeless are either going to be in encampments on the sidewalk or in safe permanent housing, and that housing needs to go somewhere.
The city's declaration of an emergency shelter crisis could add 1,500 temporary shelter beds in the coming months. In Los Angeles, I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today comes to us from Bloomberg. If you've got some spare change and a desire to be a silent partner in a Major League Baseball franchise, this could be your moment. As much as 4% of the New York Mets is coming up for sale, a vestige of an emergency cash raise that the majority partners in the club had to do to solve some Bernie Madoff-related lawsuits, if you remember those. You don't actually get a say in the running of the team for your money, but apparently you do get, Bloomberg reports, access to Mr. Met. Look that one up if you don't know who that is. A business card that says owner, a parking spot, and one day to play on the field when the team is away. All right, we got to go. Dow Jones Industrial Average added 2,238 points, not 23 points. 238 points, 1% today. NASDAQ up 114, 1.6%. S&P 527 points to the good, 1% there as well. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Danielle Irby, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Debke. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.